Hello again. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, reading Time Magazine for you on behalf of North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And welcome again. The issue of Time that we're looking at is dated February 17th, 2020. To make sure that we get the interview feature into our reading session today, we go right to the back of the book. This edition calls the feature 8 Questions. It's conducted by Suyin Haynes. The interview subject is Wad al-Kataib. Time says the Syrian documentary filmmaker on journeying through life and loss in her Oscar-nominated, and the title is For Sama. That is the name of her work nominated for an Oscar. Waad, or Wad, is spelled W-A-A-D, and then her last name is spelled lowercase A-L hyphen uppercase K-A-T-E-A-B. Waad al-Kataib. Or a variant of that attempt. Question 1. Your documentary has been nominated for an Oscar and won a BAFTA for Best Documentary. Did you expect this reaction when making the film? Answer. We were working on the film for 2 years, and we were told by so many people that no one would come to watch a Syrian film, that people are tired of Syria and want more entertaining subjects. We have been overwhelmed by reactions from people all over the world, and I couldn't believe that we were nominated for an Oscar. It makes me proud and grateful for everyone who supported me. Question. We see the war in Syria develop through your eyes. You were an economics student at the time. Why did you start filming on your phone in 2011? Answer. To be very honest, the only thing that came to my mind was how important it was to capture anything. During the first 2 years when the demonstrations in Aleppo were peaceful, we were just trying to do our roles as protesters. We were just trying to organize ourselves as a movement and trying to build evidence, because at that time the regime was denying everything that was happening. Question. How did the people around you react to your filming? Answer. In 2013, I started filming daily life. My friends were kind of annoyed by the camera at the time, and they didn't really understand why I was going out to film a massacre or film them eating or having a nice time. They would tell me to stop. Question. What changed? Answer. I lost my best friends, Gase and Omar. It gave us the feeling that we didn't know when we would be killed. After Gase was killed, we were all sitting together, and I showed everyone the footage I had. Since then, no one told me not to film. We really believed that this was the only way to tell the story, because we never thought that we would make it out. Question. Your footage archive spanned 500 hours and was filmed from 2011 to 2016. Was it a conscious decision to jump back and forth in time in For Sama? Answer. If it was truly chronological, it wasn't going to reflect the experience at all. We wanted people to understand that there was a reason for all the hard decisions we took, and it was because of hope, love, and great moments that we lived through and shared with the people of Aleppo. The flashbacks give an understanding of what we went through. Question. You gave birth to your daughter, Sama, in 2016. What do you think is the impact of viewing conflict through the eyes of women? Answer. I lived through that situation. I was a mother, and I was one of that community, so I really understood and could see all the details of that life. The way that the film started, just with one person, with no equipment, shows that it was a journey over 5 years with many struggles. If I knew that I was going to survive, I wouldn't film some of the things that I did or speak to some of the people in the way I did. Question. You play several roles in this film. Journalist, volunteer, parent. Was it difficult to balance those responsibilities? Answer. There was no balance. Day by day, I was just trying to do everything I could for my daughter, for my husband, for myself, for the filming, and the situation. There's so much of my footage that I won't use for media, but for evidence of crimes. Final question. What do you hope people take away from For Sama? Final answer. My story finished 3 years ago when I left for the UK with my family. We survived and we are safe, but there are more than 3 million people still in Syria suffering from the same circumstances. I hope people join our action campaign against the bombing of hospitals and stand in solidarity with Syria. Entire interview conducted by Suyin Haynes with Wad Al-Kateb. The documentary mentioned in this interview is For Sama. Sama is spelled S-A-M-A. Now we go to the front of the magazine, and the opening major section is the brief. And the opening section of the brief is opener, where the subsection is politics, and the headline is, Emboldened Trump Makes His 2020 Case. Article by Brian Bennett, with, Time says, reporting by Tessa Berenson, Dateline, Washington. It's Donald Trump's moment to not screw up. He survived impeachment, the greatest challenge of any president. He tightened his grip on the GOP, delivering bolts of fear by tweet and governing from the base to drive astronomical approval ratings among Republicans. He's presided over a humming economy and record low unemployment. Now, with his acquittal by the Senate, Trump has the chance to build his case for a second term. His odds look pretty good. A Gallup poll released on February 4th shows his approval rating ticking up to 49%, the highest since he took office. He is in some ways stronger than ever, with an aura of resilience bolstered by a real expansion of the power of the presidency. But a major question looms over Trump's re-election effort. Can he avoid another self-defeating mistake? His numbers may be up, but he's the only modern president never to have cleared 50%, and some experts attribute his approval struggle to the near-constant scandals and investigations of his presidency, many of his own making. From defending white supremacists and obstructing the investigations into Russia's aid to his 2016 campaign, to triggering the impeachment inquiry by pressuring Ukraine to help in his 2021, quote, Trump finds a way even in great moments to wreck them, unquote, says Republican pollster Frank Luntz. Quote, it's his own fault, unquote, adds Luntz. Quote, his Twitter outshouts his accomplishments, unquote. Trump is planning to do a lot of shouting in the coming months. He'll step up the pace of his re-election rallies, appearing in New Hampshire before the next major Democratic primary, as he did in Des Moines, Iowa, on January 30th. His campaign flooded Iowa with more than 80 surrogates to bring out voters for the largely uncontested Republican primary. It was a test run of the machinery he'll need to win swing states in November. Quote, he's going to be on the road a ton, unquote, says a White House official. In Washington, Trump's team has already pivoted from the impeachment trial to the policy proposals he'll pursue with an eye to re-election. That includes a push for new legislation to reduce drug prices and improve medical billing. He'll also go on the attack, finding ways to punish so-called sanctuary cities that Trump accuses of protecting immigrants in the country illegally. He's pressing his senior military and homeland security officials to build hundreds of miles of wall by late August, when the Republican National Convention kicks off. On balance, Trump can consider himself fortunate. Democrats gambled that by drawing attention to his alleged abuse of power, they would make the case, if not for removing him from office, then at least for voting him out. But overall, Trump's approval rating has moved only in small degrees since the impeachment inquiry began last fall, with most Americans only becoming more entrenched in their devotion or disdain for him. If anything, his acquittal by the Senate seems to have offered a modest boost for Trump. 63% of Americans now approve of how he is handling the economy, an increase of 6 points since November, Gallup found. And we move on to make sure that we get enough material and variety of material in our reading. That brings us to the subsection called The Bulletin, where the headline is, Trump's travel ban expands to 6 new countries. Article by Alejandro de la Garza, who writes, protests over President Trump's travel ban immigration policy began just days after his inauguration in 2017. Now, as he faces re-election, he's doubling down. On January 31st, the ban was extended to 6 additional countries. The new rule, which goes into effect on February 22nd, will withhold immigrant visas for applicants from Nigeria, Myanmar, Eritrea, and Kyrgyzstan, and restrict access to the U.S., diversity visa program for people from Tanzania, and Sudan. And here, De La Garza mentions 3 areas of focus. First area, security state. The administration says the latest ban affects nations with, quote, deficiencies in sharing terrorist, criminal, or identity information, unquote, and has always framed the policy as a matter of security. But during the 2016 election, Trump called for a block on Muslims entering the U.S., and the initial 2017 ban, which applied to 7 Muslim-majority countries, faced challenges on the grounds that it was discriminatory. Parenthetically, a revised version was green-lighted by the Supreme Court in 2018. The 6 newly blocked countries all have large Muslim populations. Second item of focus, outcry havoc. Trump's political opponents joined advocates in condemning the latest ban. In a joint statement, Democrat Representatives Gerald Nadler of New York and Zoe Lofgren of California said the Judiciary Committee planned to discuss legislation that would strengthen prohibitions on religious discrimination in immigration and limit executive authority on the matter. In the meantime, some applicants will be able to apply for waivers. Final area of focus, feedback loop. In Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, one civic group's anti-ban petition highlighted its impact on U.S. citizens with family there. Nearly 8,000 immigrant visas went to Nigerians in fiscal year 2018. And rights groups expressed concern for potential immigrants from Myanmar, where the Rohingya Muslim minority faces persecution. But Trump's base tends to respond well to hardline immigration policy. So, as the 2020 race continues, the reaction that politicians hear may come from closer to home. Sharing the page here is the sidebar feature, News Ticker. As always, it is three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Pompeo visits Ukraine, offers reassurance. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reaffirmed U.S. support for Ukraine's, quote, struggle for freedom, democracy, and prosperity, unquote, during a visit to the country on January 31st. Just as President Trump's impeachment trial on accusations related to withholding military aid for Ukraine was coming to an end. Little item, EU rejects U.S. peace plan for Middle East. The EU said on February 4th it couldn't support key elements of the Trump administration's plan for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as it, quote, departs from, unquote, internationally agreed parameters. Further quote, the plan, which gave a green light to Israel to annex parts of the West Bank, was also rejected by the Palestinians. Bottom item, Trump administration reverses landmine rule. The White House lifted a restriction on the use of anti-personnel landmines outside the Korean Peninsula on January 31st, saying the Obama-era ban could put U.S. forces at, quote, a severe disadvantage during a conflict, unquote. More than 150 countries have joined a 1997 treaty banning the use of anti-personnel landmines. That was News Ticker, top to bottom. Moving forward, we are now at the milestones page. Under died Mary Higgins Clark, the Queen of Suspense. Observance written by Annabel Guterman. She writes, in 1969, when Mary Higgins Clark published her debut, Aspire to the Heavens, she was a widowed mother of five in her 40s who found the time to write early in the morning, often waking up at 5 a.m. to put pen to paper. Her work ethic led to commercial success a decade later after she released her first suspense novel, Where Are the Children? The mystery thriller catapulted the writer to prominence in the genre and eventually earned her the nickname Queen of Suspense. By the time of her death at 92 on January 31st, Higgins Clark had written more than 50 best-selling novels. In the U.S. alone, her books have sold more than 100 million copies. Most of Higgins Clark's stories are centered on women dealing with crises, whether haunted by past trauma or thrown into peril after witnessing a crime. In a 1997 interview with the New York Times, the author said she wrote about, quote, nice people whose lives are invaded, unquote. Her most recent novel, Kiss the Girls and Make Them Cry, published in November 2019, fits the bill, following a female journalist as she investigates a murder at a television news network. In focusing her narratives on relatable and realistic characters, Higgins Clark crafted addictive page-turners that resonated with readers. After her death, her longtime editor, Michael Korda, wrote about this quality, quote, she was the queen of suspense. It wasn't just a phrase. She always set out to end each chapter on a note of suspense, so you just had to keep reading, unquote. Observance by Annabel Guterman, Mary Higgins Clark. This item is accompanied by a full-length color candid, even though it may be posed, but it is a shot of her at her office, photograph of Mary Higgins Clark. The caption will explain better than your reader. The caption says, The first suspense novel by Higgins Clark, Above in 2002, is currently in its 75th edition in paperback. And in the picture, Mary Higgins Clark is sitting presumably at her desk looking at the camera, and spread out on the carpet at her feet are many books, many of which are open. In the right margin of the page, under Died, Alice Mayhew, Insider's Edition, observance by Walter Isaacson. Time says, Isaacson, a former editor of Time, wrote 7 books for Mayhew, including biographies of Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, and Leonardo da Vinci. Walter Isaacson writes, with a salty passion that could be abrupt but endearing most of the time, book editor Alice Mayhew, who died on February 4th at 87, helped create the nonfiction genre of the blockbuster Washington Insider tale. For almost 50 years, she shepherded waves of writers whom she prodded to combine journalistic reporting with literary storytelling. She had a theological belief in chronological narrative and would slash from a manuscript any self-indulgent diversions and scribble in the margins, quote, all things in good time, unquote, when an author tried to flash forward or circle back when telling a tale. Books were her life, and with her raspy laugh and intense stare, she helped her writers turn half-baked notions into sharply themed stories. Those who benefited from her skill were legion, beginning with Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, whose Watergate reporting saga she shaped into All the President's Men. But her greatest joy, I believe, came not from her famous writers, but from the fledgling ones she helped launch, year after year, into her charmed realm of Alice authors. Observance written by Walter Isaacson, Alice Mayhew. This item is accompanied by a half-length color photo of Alice Mayhew with no caption. In the left margin, under Died, former WorldCom chief Bernard Ebbers, on February 2nd, died at 78. He was sentenced in 2005, to 25 years in prison for his role in an accounting scandal, but released in December because of failing health. Under Died, Daniel Arap Moi, Kenya's longest-serving president, died on February 4th at 95. Under Acquitted, 3 doctors involved in a 2010 euthanasia, acquitted by a Belgian court on January 31st, in a test of the country's assisted death law. Under Dropped, apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border for the 8th straight month in January. The total of roughly 29,200 represented a 10% drop from December. Under Dropped Out, Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney on January 31st. Under Diagnosed, conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh with advanced lung cancer, an illness he revealed on February 3rd. Under Revised, the number of U.S. service members injured in Iranian missile strikes on bases in Iraq on January 8th, revised up to 64 by the Pentagon on January 30th. Issued a warrant for former South African President Jacob Zuma's arrest, issued on corruption charges on February 4th, after he failed to appear in court. His lawyers say he was receiving medical care outside the country. The entire contents of the Milestones page. On the facing page, still in the brief, the subsection here is news, and the subsection is Good Question, a regular feature, where the headline is Brexit Finally Happened. But will Scotland end up back in the EU? Question mark. Item by Sierra Nugent, who writes, although Britain officially exited the European Union on January 31st, not everyone in the UK has given up on EU membership. On February 2nd, the Scottish National Party, parenthetically SNP, which wants Scotland to secede from the UK and then rejoin the EU, celebrated when former European Council President Donald Tusk said the bloc would be, quote, enthusiastic, unquote, about letting Scotland back in. The UK accused Tusk, who left his role in November, of encouraging, quote, separatist tendencies, unquote, across Europe. But Scottish leaders hardly need encouragement. Brexit, backed by only 38% of Scottish voters, has heightened tensions between Edinburgh and London, with SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon arguing Scots are being, quote, dragged, unquote, out of the bloc against their will. She has demanded a referendum on Scottish independence in 2020. Ever since Scotland and England united in 1707, a small minority has wanted to split. But the SNP's rise to dominate Scottish politics over the past decade has made those voices louder. Competence and popular leftist policies were arguably more key to the SNP's rise than support for independence, which hovered below a third until 2014. That year, the UK government held a referendum on independence. Though the pro-independence camp lost, its 45% of the vote was higher than expected and reinvigorated the cause. Brexit has since fueled support for independence, which some recent polls put at 50% or higher. It's also made the EU more sympathetic to Scotland's independence movement, says James Mitchell, politics professor at Edinburgh University. Quote, the advantages of Scottish membership would far outweigh any disadvantages for the EU, unquote, he says. Quote, also, Brexit was a slap in the face, so Scotland rejoining could be a symbolic boon. Unquote. But Brexit has also created practical obstacles for an independent Scotland. It would now border a non-EU country, requiring border checks between deeply intertwined regions, similar to the problem at the Irish border that complicated Brexit talks. Economic headwinds from Brexit and independence would also make it harder to clear fiscal hurdles for new member states. Whatever the EU says, Scotland needs the support of the UK Parliament to call a referendum, something Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ruled out. Johnson has a large majority in Parliament and is planning a multi-million dollar advertising campaign urging Scots to protect the Union. But pressure looks set to build. Sturgeon hasn't ruled out eventually holding a non-binding poll to prove a mandate for independence. And the SNP will likely promise a referendum in its Scottish Parliament election manifesto next year. Quote, if Johnson thinks love-bombing Scotland will work, he doesn't understand what happens up here, unquote. Mitchell says, quote, there's a perception that we want to head in a different direction. That divergence isn't going to stop, unquote. Entire article by Sierra Nugent. As we move forward, we are now in the major section called The View, the subsection Business, where the headline is, it's time to retire old ideas about retirement. Article by Tara Law. Craig Ogley worked in Pennsylvania public schools for about 40 years before calling it quits in 2007. He regretted it almost instantly. Just 1 month after retiring, he took a new job as a principal in New Jersey. Quote, I just really did not think through my decision to retire, unquote, says Ogilvy, now 72, and working as a consultant. Quote, I thought I was ready, but I soon realized that I need to continue to be active, unquote. Like Ogilvy, many Americans are rethinking the latter end of their careers. As of February 2019, more than 20% of Americans over 65 were working or looking for work, nearly twice the 1985 rate. Workers are retiring 3 years later on average than they did in the 1980s, according to Matthew Rutledge of Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. The phenomenon could give the wider economy a boost as older workers keep earning and spending money. What's keeping older workers at work? For one, their health is generally better, allowing them to stay at their jobs longer. Americans' life expectancy at birth reached 78.7 years in 2018, compared with 73.7 in 1980. Finances also matter. The age required to receive full Social Security benefits is being gradually increased to 67, leading some workers to stick around until they can get their maximum benefits. Furthermore, employers are switching from pensions, which for some workers become substantial enough to comfortably replace their paycheck in retirement, to contribution-based plans like 401ks, which are typically less dependable as a sole retirement account, but can grow so long as a worker keeps making contributions with no age limit. Then there's the psychological factor. For career-driven people like Ogilvy, downshifting from a career-first mindset into the, quote, permanent vacation, unquote, of retirement can be unmooring and even downright scary. It may, after all, be one of the last major life changes we make on our own. Nancy Schlossberg, a professor emerita at the University of Maryland, who has written several books on retirement, says it's the little stuff that retirees wind up struggling with the most. Quote, when you leave work, you are giving up your relationships with colleagues, you are giving up your role, you are giving up your assumptions about the world, unquote, she says. Quote, but most important, you are giving up your routines, where you stopped for coffee, where you dropped your cleaning off on the way to work, unquote. Of course, many Americans have less agency when it comes to their retirement plans. Less educated workers tend to retire earlier, for instance. The average retirement age for males with less education than a college degree barely budged between the 1980s and 2016, increasing only from 62.6 to 62.8, according to Rutledge. The gap exists in part because less educated workers tend to have more physically demanding jobs that wear people down. Others retire because saving money while barely making ends meet begins to feel like a Sisyphean undertaking. Quote, a lot of people think, no matter what they do, they're really never going to be able to save very much, unquote, says Rutledge. Still others can't find work that matches their skill set in our rapidly evolving economy. That's the case for Angela Carambo, a 56-year-old New Yorker, who says her lack of a college degree has held her back for decades since she lost a service job at a publishing firm 20 years ago. Quote, before, it was always train for the job, unquote, says Carambo, who's planning to go on Social Security as soon as she can. Quote, now you have to have this, you have to have that, and I didn't have any of these, unquote. But for those who have the luxury of delaying retirement, the benefits can extend beyond their bank accounts. Staying in the workforce can give older Americans a chance to try something different, whether it's part-time or consulting work in their long-time field or a totally new venture. Even absent a major change, work can give older Americans an often necessary sense of purpose. That's the case for Ruth Schwartz, a 74-year-old academic who teaches a graduate-level database course at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. Quote, I thought to myself, what am I going to do for 40 years? It's not like it used to be where you retired at 65 and you died at 75, unquote, says Schwartz. Quote, I know other people who are just happy to sit at home. I can't imagine it, unquote. Entire article by Tara Law. That brings us to what is the cover story. The major section here is World, and the headline is Crisis Mode. The coronavirus outbreak presents the greatest threat yet to Xi Jinping's ambition for a Chinese century. Cover article by Charlie Campbell, Dateline, Shanghai. It took 8 hours for a doctor to see Wu Chen's mother after she arrived at the hospital. 8 days later, she was dead. The doctor was, quote, 99% sure, unquote, she had contracted the mysterious pneumonia-like illness sweeping China's central city of Wuhan. Wu says, but he didn't have the testing kit to prove it. And despite the 64-year-old's fever and perilously low oxygen levels, there was no bed for her. Wu tried 2 more hospitals over the next week, but all were overrun. By January 25th, her mother was slumped on the tile floor of an emergency room, gasping for air, drifting in and out of consciousness. Quote, we didn't want to see my mom die on the floor, so we took her home, unquote, says Wu, 30. Quote, she passed the next day, unquote. Because she did not want a spell in jail for dissent to compound her grief, Wu asked time to refer to her by a pseudonym, a reasonable request, and one that carries with it a measure of what each virus death means to the People's Republic of China. The novel coronavirus known as 2019-nCoV threatens more than the 24,000 people known to be infected as of February 4th, or the 492 it has killed. It also looms over the National Rejuvenation Project of President Xi Jinping and the rigid top-down rule being tested by all that the disease brings with it, including distrust in a population the government pledged to keep safe. Since China belatedly acknowledged the severity of the outbreak, every organ of the Chinese state has been harnessed to enforce an unprecedented quarantine on 50 million people across 15 cities. China's government has unleashed a 1 billion yuan, and parenthetically, that is $142 million, war chest, 1 billion yuan war chest, to fight the outbreak amid a frenzy of construction work that, among other feats, erected a 1,000-bed hospital in just 10 days. That there was no cot for Wu's mother may be understandable given the time it took to comprehend the disease and how quickly it spread. But what to make of a government that cannot abide the grief of a daughter who took her ailing mother home rather than see her die on a hospital floor? We depart from the text for one moment to read the caption of a photograph that spreads across both pages of the beginning of the article, and the caption says it all. An empty highway in Wuhan, the city of 11 million, where the outbreak began in a market on February 3rd. Now, the highway mentioned in the caption is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lanes across, including an overpass. There is not an automobile in sight, nor on the off-ramp or on-ramp. And as far as the eyes can see, there is not a human being. There is not a motor vehicle. And a very tall skyscraper rises in the smog in the far distance. Transparency is essential to public health. But in China, doctors who reported the reality of the outbreak have been arrested for, quote, spreading rumors, unquote. Officials were pictured pocketing supplies meant for frontline medical staff, who were reduced to cutting up office supplies for makeshift surgical masks. Meanwhile, the ruling Chinese Communist Party, parenthetically CCP, has already started leveraging the crisis for propaganda by lionizing cadres leading containment efforts. Quote, no crisis is too deadly that they can't take a timeout to promote the party through manipulation of it, unquote, says Scott W. Harold, an East Asia expert at the U.S. policy think tank RAND Corporation. In the fall of 2017, Xi took the podium at Beijing's Great Hall of the People to claim that China's version of one-party autocracy offered an option for countries that want to speed up their development while preserving their independence, unquote. Western democracy was messy and flawed, the argument went. And the years since that speech, China's hubris has grown, nurtured by the tumultuous U.S. presidency of Donald Trump and the disintegration of the multilateral world order. But the coronavirus crisis threatens to rattle China's authoritarian apparatus. Quote, a major test of China's system and capacity for governance, unquote, senior party chiefs called it on February 3rd. The 2019-NCOV outbreak is infecting some 2,000 people daily in China and has spread to at least 25 countries. And for clarity here, I will spell out the name of the virus specifically, explicitly, 2019 hyphen lowercase N, uppercase C, lowercase o, uppercase V. Article goes on to say, the World Health Organization, parenthetically WHO, declared it a, quote, global health emergency, unquote. And the fear is not limited to health. Global commerce now hinges on China's $14.55 trillion economy, which in turn is governed by an opaque authoritarian regime tightly coalesced around one man. Xi, burnished by a resurgent cult of personality, has amassed more power than any Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. He has leveraged Beijing's economic clout to forward ambitions at home and abroad, but also has struggled as no previous leader. Quote, since Xi came to power, problem after problem have occurred on his watch that he seems unable to effectively manage, unquote, says Jude Blanchett, a China analyst at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. These include popular unrest in semi-autonomous Hong Kong, a disruptive trade war with the U.S., and now an unfolding health crisis. For decades, the sales pitch for China's single-party rule was the superior performance of its political system when faced with both short-term crises and long-term challenges. It built thousands of miles of high-speed rail and helped drag hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. By 2022, McKinsey predicts 550 million Chinese will be able to call themselves middle class, about 1.5 times the current U.S. population. Still, that benevolent narrative has deteriorated under Xi. Now the coronavirus threatens to undermine further his mission to have China stake out the next century as America did the last. In 2019, China overtook Soviet Russia as history's most enduring communist state. The seven-decade longevity of the CCP can be attributed in no small part to abandoning great chunks of Marxism-Leninism instead of centralized planning and top-down targets. China embraced markets and devolved considerable power to its regions and cities. Local party bosses were encouraged to make bold decisions to boost the local economy, like setting up heavily subsidized means of production. As a result, China boomed, but also became a network of little fiefdoms and power centers, where local bosses vied for influence and corruption flourished. Xi came into power in 2012, convinced rampant graft posed an existential threat to the party. To him, only an ideological renaissance coupled with an anti-corruption crusade could save China from going the way of the Soviet Union. A bland apparatchik by reputation, Xi climbed the career ladder of a provincial bureaucrat, eventually emerging as a compromise candidate for the post of China's top leader. His lack of a power base led party elders to believe he would remain malleable and easy to control. Global leaders hoped he might push through long-awaited economic and social reforms. They were wrong. Soon after taking power, Xi announced his, quote, China dream, unquote, of a grand national rejuvenation, later speaking about returning China to, quote, center stage of the world, unquote. Far from embracing Western-style market reforms, Xi calcified state control over the economy and stocked its bureaucracy with flunkies and yes-men. Today, party zealotry permeates all of Chinese society. the head of China's National Film Bureau, has ordered movies, quote, must have a clear ideological bottom line and cannot challenge the political system, unquote. China's journalists have been instructed to follow, quote, Marxist news values, unquote. Artists can only produce works that, quote, serve the people and socialism, unquote. One advertisement for sperm donors required applicants ages 20 to 45 with, quote, excellent ideological qualities, unquote, who, quote, love the fatherland, unquote, and are, quote, loyal, unquote, to the party's, quote, mission, unquote. Mao may have had his little red book, but Xi has a personalized app distributed to all 90 million CCP members with a directory of his speeches and quizzes on his life and political thought. His mission is to forge a singular Chinese identity that restores the nation's ethnic Han majority to a golden age on the basis of fealty to his party. Quote, Xi Jinping is fundamentally a Han chauvinist with a, quote, historic mission, unquote, to make China, Han China, great again, quote, unquote, says Professor Steve Tsong, director of SOAS China Institute at the University of London. And he's willing to go to extreme lengths to do it. In China's restive Xinjiang province, a systematic campaign of forced internment has transformed the area into a dusty expanse spotted with camps where more than 1 million Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities are held extrajudicially, according to the UN. What began as a campaign to battle radical Islam in the region has mutated into an enormous project of ideological re-education. On the routes where Silk Road caravans once traveled, a sophisticated surveillance apparatus shrouds the wider populace in an AI-powered panopticon, where every action is watched, recorded, and judged by algorithm. Those who fall foul of it are sent to learn the error of their ways. Naran Kokenbai, 56, never found out the charges against him, but from August 2017 to April 2018, he was detained in a re-education camp close to the city of Yil in Xinjiang province. For 4 hours each morning, Kokenbai says he and his fellow inmates were forced to watch videos of Xi carousing with dignitaries and overseeing military exercises. They were also ordered to memorize Xi's eponymous, quote, political thought, unquote, and documents from the 19th CCP conference, where Xi removed presidential term limits to enable himself to rule for life. Those that resisted were beaten with sticks or strapped to a metal chair for interrogation. Quote, they weren't testing our knowledge or loyalty, unquote, Kokenbai told Time in Almaty, Kazakhstan, to which he has since fled. Quote, they were just filling us with this propaganda, unquote. President Trump has kept mum on the Xinjiang camps as he negotiated a provisional agreement in the trade war. But when the coronavirus broke, his administration did not hold back. Quote, I don't want to talk about a victory lap over a very unfortunate, very malignant disease, unquote, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said in a TV interview on January 30th. Quote, the fact is, it does give business yet another thing to consider. I think it will help to accelerate the return of jobs to North America. Unquote. 40 years after Beijing and Washington normalized relations, the two are diverging rapidly. Under Trump, the U.S. has been disengaging its firms and, yes, supply chains from China through taxes, tariffs, and punitive investment curbs. Western investors are also cowed by ideological hurdles and looking elsewhere, given China's market is now sophisticated, saturated, and tricky to exploit. Washington has banned Huawei, the world's biggest telecom equipment manufacturer, from its key infrastructure and urged allies to do the same. In U.S. universities, Chinese researchers have been purged as academia, wary of espionage, lurches into Sinophobic McCarthyism. The patient optimism that colored the George W. Bush and Obama administrations has largely evaporated. And we have run out of time for today's edition of Time Magazine. We hope that this has been informative. There was a lot of material. In spite of the errors of your loyal reader, for which I, Randall Rickman, do apologize. The content of this program is intended for folks who are blind and print impaired. You've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Once again, that is ncreadingservice.org. Yet another error by your reader. So, if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I will repeat, 919-832-5138. We certainly appreciate you being with us again for time, because, as always, this time is your time.